Ladies and gentlemen, the Department of English of the University of Virginia is honored to present Mr. Faulkner, and is also very pleased that so many of you were able to travel so many of you long distances to be present this afternoon. Mr. Faulkner will first read from his short story, Shingles for the Lord, and when that is finished, is open to questions in any direction. Mr. Faulkner.
Pat got up a good hour before daylight and caught the mule and rid down to Killigrew's to borrow the straw and mow. He ought to been back with it in 40 minutes, but the sun had rose and I had done milked and fed and was eating my breakfast when he got back, with the mule not only in the lather but right on the edge of the thumps too. Fox hunting, he said, fox hunting. A 70-year-old man with both feet and one knee too, already in the grave, squatting all night on the hill and calling himself listening to a fox graze that he couldn't even hear unless they had come right up onto the same log he was setting on and bayed into his air trumpet. Give me my breakfast, he told Ma. Whitfield is standing there right this minute, straddled of that board tree with his watch in his hand. And he was. We rid on past the church, and there was not only Soaring Quick school bus truck, but Reverend Whitfield old mare, too. We tied the mule to a sapling and hung our dunner bucket on a limb, and with Pap toting Killigrew's fro and maul and the wedges and me toting our axe, we went on to the board tree where Soaring and Homer Bookwright, with their froes and mauls and axes and wedges, were setting on two upended cuts. And Whitfield was standing just like Pap said, in his boy's shirt and his black hat and pants and necktie, holding his watch in his hand. It was gold, and in the morning sunlight it looked as big as a full-grown squash. You're late, he said. So Pap told him again about how old man Killigrew had been off fox hunting all night, and nobody at home to lend him the fro but Miss Killigrew and the cook. And naturally, the cook wasn't going to lend none of Killigrew's tools out, and Miss Killigrew was worse of death than even Killigrew. If you was to run in and tell her the house was afire, she would just keep on rocking and say she thought so too. Unless she begun to holler back to the cook to turn the dogs loose before you could even open your mouth. You could have gone yesterday and borrowed the fro, Whitfield said. You have known for a month now that you had promised this one day out of a whole summer toward putting a roof on the house of God. We ain't but 2 hours late, Pap said. I reckon the Lord will forgive it. He ain't interested in time, nohow. He's interested in salvation. Whitfield never even waited for Pap to finish. It looked to me like he even got taller, thundering down at Pap like a cloud burst. He ain't interested in neither. Why should he be when he owns them both? And why should he turn around for the poor, middling souls of men that can't even borrow tools in time to replace the shingles on his church? I don't know either. Maybe it's just because he made them. Maybe he just said to himself, I made them. I don't know why. But since I did, I got free. I'll roll my sleeves up and drag them into glory, whether they will or no. But that wasn't here nor there neither now. And I reckon he knowed it, just like he knowed there wasn't going to be nothing at all here as long as he stayed. So he put the watch back into his pocket and motioned Sol and Homer up, and we all taken off our hats except him. While he stood there with his face raised into the sun and his eyes shut and his eyebrows looking big like iron gray caterpillars laying along the edge of a cliff, Lord, he said, make them good straight shingles to lay smooth and let them split out easy. They're for you. And opened his eyes and looked at us again, most at Pap, and went and untied his man, come up slow and stiff, like old men do, and rid away. Pap put down the fro and maul and laid the three wedges in a neat row on the ground and taken up the axe. Well, men, he said, let's get started. We already late. Me and Homer ain't, Solon said. We was here. This time, him and Homer didn't set on the cuts. They squatted on their heels. Then I seen that Homer was whittling on a stick. I hadn't noticed it before. I make it 2 hours and a little over, Solon said, more or less. Pap was still about half stooped over, holding the axe. It's now one, he said, but call it two for the sake of the argument. What about it? What argument, Homer said. All right, Pat said, 2 hours then. What about it? Which is 3 man-hour units a hour, multiplied by 2 hours, Solon said, or a total of 6 work units. When the WPA first come to Yautnapatawpha County and started giving out jobs and grubbing mattresses, Solon went in to Jefferson to get on it. He would drive his school bus truck the 22 miles into town every morning and come back that night. He'd done that for almost a week before he found out he would not only have to sign his farm off into somebody else's name, he couldn't even own and run the school bus that he had built himself. So he'd come back that night and never went back no more, and since then had nobody better mention WPNA to him unless they aimed to fight too. Though every now and then he would turn up with something all figured down into work units, like he'd done now, 6 units short, 4 of which you and Homer could have already worked out while you were sitting here waiting on me, Pat said. Except that we didn't, Solon said. We promised Whitfield 2 units of 12 3-unit hours toward getting some new shingles on the church roof. We've been here ever since sunup waiting for the 3rd unit to show up so we could start. You don't seem to kept up with these modern ideas about work that's been flooding and uplifting the country in the last few years. What modern ideas, Pap said. I didn't know there was but one idea about work until it is done and ain't done. And when it is done, it is. Homer made another long, steady whittle on the stick. His knife was sharp as a razor. Solon taken out his snuff box and filled the top and tilted the snuff into his lip and offered the box to Homer, and Homer shaking his head, and Solon put the top back on the box and put the box back into his pocket. So Pap said, just because I had to wait 2 hours for an old 70-year man to get back from fox hunting, never had no more business sitting out in the woods all night than he would have had sitting all night in a highway juke joint, we all 3 have got to come back here tomorrow to finish them 2 hours that you and Homer, I ain't, Solon said, I don't know about Homer, I promised Whitfield one day, I was here at sunup to start it, when the sun goes down I will consider I have done finished it. I see, Pap said, I see, it's me that's got to come back. By myself, I got to break into a full morning to make up them 2 hours that you and Homer spent resting. I got to spend 2 hours of the next day making up for the 2 hours of the day before that you and Homer never even worked. It's going to more than just break into a morning, Solon said. It's going to wreck it. There's 6 units left over, 6 one-man-hour units. Maybe you can work twice as fast as me and Homer put together and finish them in 4 hours, but I don't believe you can work 3 times as fast and finish in 2. Maybe there's something else besides cash you might be able to trade with, Solon said. You might use that dog. That was when Pap actually stopped. I didn't know it myself then either, but I found out a good long time before Solon did. Pap sat there with the maul up over his head and the blade of the fro set against the block for the next lick, looking up at Solon. The dog, he said. It was a kind of mixed hound with a little bird dog and some collie and maybe a considerable of almost anything else. But it would ease through the woods without no more noise than a hag and pick up a squirrel's trail on the ground and bark just once, unless it knowed you was where you could see it, and then tiptoe that trail out just like a man and never make another sound until it treed, and only then when it knowed you hadn't kept in sight of it. It belonged to Pap and Vernon and Tull together. Will Varner gave it to Tull as a puppy, and Pap raised it for a half interest. Me and him trained it, and it slept in my bed with me until it got so big Maul finally run it out of the house. And for the last 6 months, Solon had been trying to buy it. Him and Tull had agreed on $2 for Tull's half of it. But Solon and Pap were still $6 apart on Allen because Pap said it was worth $10 of anybody's money, and if Tull wasn't going to collect his half of that, he was going to collect it for him. So that's it, Pap said. Them things wasn't work units at all. They was dog units. Just a suggestion, Solon said. Just a friendly offer to keep them runaway shingles from breaking up your private business for 6 hours tomorrow morning. You sell me your half of that trick overgrown fice, and I'll finish these shingles for you. Naturally, including them 6 extra units of $1, Pap said. No, no, Solon said. I'll pay you the same $2 for your half of that dog that me and Tull agreed on for his half of it. You meet me here tomorrow morning with the dog, and you can go on back home or wherever them urgent private fairs are located and forget about that church group. Your half of the dog for that half a day's work you still owe on them shingles. And the $2, Pap said, that you and Tull agreed on. I sell you half the dog for $2, and you come back here tomorrow and finish the shingles. You give me the $2 now, and I'll meet you here in the morning with the dog, and you can show me the receipt from Turl for his half then. Me and Turl have already agreed, Solon said. All right, Pap said, then you can pay Turl his $2 and bring his receipt with you without no trouble. Turl will be at the church tomorrow morning pulling off them old shingles, Solon said. All right, Pap said, then it won't be no trouble at all for you to get a receipt from him. You can stop at the church when you pass. Turl ain't named Greer. He don't need to be off somewhere tomorrow morning, borrowing a crowbar. So Solon taken out his purse and paid Pap $2, and they went back to work. And now it looked like they was really trying to finish that afternoon, not just Solon, but even Homer, that didn't even seem to be concerned in it, nohow. And Pap, that had already swapped half a dog to get rid of whatever work Solon claimed would be left over. I quit trying to stay up with them. I just stacked shingles. Then Solon laid his fro and maul down. Well, men, he said, I don't know what you fellows think, but I consider this a day. All right, Pap said, you're the one to decide when to quit, since whatever elbow units you consider are going to be shot tomorrow will be yours. That's a fact, Solon said, and since I'm giving a day and a half to the church instead of just a day, like I started out doing, I reckon I better get on home and tend to a little of my own work. He picked up his fro and maul and axe and went to his truck and stood waiting for Homer to come and get in. I'll be here in the morning with the dog, Pap said. Sholish, Solon said. It sounded like he had forgot about the dog, or that it wasn't no longer any importance. But he stood there again and looked hard and quiet at Pap for about a second. And a bill of sale from Tull for his half of it. As you say, it won't be no trouble at all to get that from him. Him and Homer got into the truck and he started the engine. You couldn't say just what it was. It was almost like Solon was hurrying himself, so Pap wouldn't have to make any excuse or pretense toward doing or not doing anything. I have always understood the fact that lightning don't have to hit twice is one of the reasons why they named it lightning. So getting lightning struck is a mistake that might happen to any man. The mistake I seem to made is I never realized in time that what I was looking at was a cloud. I'll see you in the morning. With the dog, Pap said. Certainly, Solon said. Again, like it had slipped his mind completely. With the dog. Then him and Homer drove off. Then Pap got up. What, I said, what? You swapped him your half of Tull's dog for that half a day's work tomorrow. Now what? Yes, Pap said, only before that I had already swapped Tull a half day's work pulling off them old shingles tomorrow for Tull's half of that dog. Only we ain't got to wait until tomorrow. We're going to pull them shingles off tonight without no more racket about it than necessary. I don't aim to have nothing on my mind tomorrow but watching Mr. Solon work unit quick trying to get a bill of sale for $2 or $10 either on the upper half of that dog. And we'll do it tonight. I don't want him just to find out at sunup tomorrow that he was too late. I want him to find out then that even when he had laid down to sleep, he was already too late. So we went back home, and I fed and milked while Pap went down to kill a goose to carry the fro and maul back and borrow a crowbar. But of all places in the world and doing hot under the sun with it, old man Killigrew had went and lost his crowbar out of a boat in 40 feet of water. And Pap said how he come within an inch of going to Solon's and borrowing his crowbar out of pure poetic justice. Only Solon might have smelled the rat just from the idea of the crowbar. So Pap went to Armstead's and borrowed his'n and come back and we ate supper and cleaned and filled the lather while Ma still tried to find out what we was up to that couldn't wait till morning. We left her still talking, even as far as the front gate, and come on back to the church walking this time with the rope and crowbar and a hammer for me and the lantern still dark. Whitfield and Snopes was unloading a ladder from Snopes' wagon when we passed the church on the way home before dark, so all we had to do was to set the ladder up against the church. Then Pap clumb up onto the roof with the lantern and pulled off shingles until he could hang the lantern inside behind the decking where it could shine out through the cracks in the planks. But you couldn't see it unless you was passing in the road, and by that time anybody would have already heard us. Then I climbed up with the rope, and Pap reached it through the decking and around a rafter and back and tied the ends around our waist, and we started, and we went at it. We had them old shingles just raining down, me using the claw hammer and Pap using the crowbar. working the bar under a whole patch of shingles at one time and then laying back on the bar like in one more lick. Or if the crowbar ever happened for 1 second to get a solid hold, he would tilt the whole roof up at one time like a hinged box lid. That's exactly what he finally done. He laid back on the bar, and this time he got a hold. It wasn't just a patch of shingles, it was a whole section of decking, so that when he lunged back, he snatched that whole section of roof from around the lantern like he would shuck a corn of it. The lantern was hanging on a nail. He never even moved the nail. He just pulled the board off it, so that it looked like for a whole minute I watched the lantern and the crowbar too sitting there in the empty air in a little mess of floating shingles, with the empty nail still sticking through the bale of the lantern before the whole thing started down into the church. It hit the floor and bounced once. Then it hit the floor again, and this time the whole church just blowed up into a pit of yellow jumping fire, with me and Pap hanging over the edge of it on two ropes. I don't know what became of the rope, nor how we got out of it. I don't remember climbing down, just Pap yelling behind me and pushing me halfway down the ladder, and then throwing me the rest of the way by a handful of my overhauls. And then we was both on the ground running for the water barrel. It sat under the gutter spout at the side, and Armstead was there then. He had happened to go out to his lot about an hour back and seen the lantern on the church roof, and it stayed on his mind until finally he come up to see what was going on, and got there just in time to stand yelling back and forth with Pap across the water barrel. And I believe we still would have put it out. Pap turned and squatted against the barrel and got a hold of it over his shoulder, and stood up with that barrel that was almost full, and run around the corner up the steps of the church, and hooked his toe on the top step and come down with the barrel busting on top of him and knocking him cold out as a wedge. So we had to drag him back first, and Ma was there then, and Ms. Armstead about the same time, and me and Armstead run with the two fire buckets to the spring, and when we got back there was a plenty there, Whitfield too, with more buckets, and we done what we could, but the spring was 200 yards away and 10 buckets emptied it, and it had taken 5 minutes to fill again. So finally we all just stood around where Pap had come to again with a big cut on his head and watched it go. It was an old church, long dried out and full of old colored picture charts that Whitfield had accumulated for more than 50 years, that the lantern had lit right in the middle of when it finally exploded. There was a special nail where he would keep an old long nightshirt he would wear to baptize in. I used to watch it all the time during church and Sunday school, and me and the other boys would go past the church sometime just to peep in at it, because to a boy of 10 it wasn't just a cloth garment or even an iron armor. It was the old strong archangel Michael himself that had fit and strove and conquered sin for so long that it finally had the same contempt for the human beings that returned always to sin as hogs and dogs done that the old strong archangel himself must have had. So for a long time it never burned, even after everything else inside had. We could watch it hanging there among the fire, not like it had knowed in its time too much water to burn easy, but like it had strove and fit with the devil and all the hosts of hell too long to burn in just a fire like a respirator started, trying to beat slow and quick out of half a dog. But at last it went too, not in a hurry still, but just all at once, kind of roaring right up on and out against the stars in the far dark spaces. And then there wasn't nothing but just Pap, drenched and groggy, looking on the ground, with the rest of us around him. And Whitfield, like always, in his boy's shirt and his black hat and pants, standing there with his hat on, too, like he had strove too long to save what hadn't ought to have been created in the first place, from the damnation that didn't even want to escape, to bother to need to take his hat off in any presence. He looked around at us from under it. We was all there now, all that belonged to that church and used it to be born and marry and die from, us and the Armsteads and Tulls and Bookwrights and Quick and Snopeses. I was wrong, Whitfield said. I told you we would meet here tomorrow at the roof of church. We meet here in the morning to raise one. Of course we got to have a church, Pap said. We're going to have one, and we're going to have it soon. But there's some of us done already give a day or so this week at the cost of our own work, which is right and just, and we're going to give more and glad to you. But I don't believe that the Lord, Whitfield let him finish. He never moved. He just stood there till Pap finally run down out of his own accord and hushed, and sat there on the ground, mostly not looking at Ma, before Whitfield opened his mouth. Not you, Whitfield said. Arsonist? Arsonist, Pap said. Yes, Whitfield said. If there is any pursuit in which you can engage without carrying flood and fire and destruction and death behind you, do it. But not one hand shall you lay to this new house until you have proved to us that you are to be trusted again with the powers and capacities of a man. He looked about at us again. Tull and Snopes and Armstead have already promised for tomorrow. I understand that Quick had another half day he intended. I can give another day, Solon said. I can give the rest of the week, Homer said. I ain't rushing either, Snopes said. That will be enough to start with then, Whitfield said. It's late now. Let us all go home. He went first. He didn't look back once. At the church or at us, he went to the old man, clung up slow and stiff and powerful, and was gone. And we went to scattering. But I looked back at it. It was just a shell now with a red and fading core, and I had hated it at times and feared it at others, and I should have been glad, but there was something that even that fire hadn't even touched. Maybe that's all it was, just indestructibility, endurability. That old man that could plan to build it back while its walls were still fire fierce and then calmly turn his back and go away because he knew that the men that had never had nothing to give toward the new one but their work would be there snug tomorrow. And the day after that, and the day after that too, as long as was needed, to give that work to build it back again. So it hadn't gone at all. It didn't no more care for that little fire and flood than Whitfield's old baptizing gown had done. Then we was home. Ma had left so fast, the lamp was still lit, and we could see Pap now, still leaving a puddle where he stood, with a cut across the back of his head where the barrel had busted and the blood-streaked water soaking him to the waist. Get them wet clothes off, Ma said. I don't know as I will or not, Pap said. I've been publicly notified that I ain't fitting to associate with white folks, so I publicly notified them same white folks and Methodists too not to try to associate with me, or the devil can have the hindmost. But Ma hadn't even listened. When she come back with a pan of water and a towel and a liniment bottle, Pap was already in his nightshade. I don't want none of that neither, he said. If my head wasn't worth busting, it ain't worth patching. But she never paid no mind to that neither. She washed his head off and dried it and put the bandage on and went out again, and Pap went and got into bed. Hand me my snuff, then you get out of here and stay out too, he said. But before I could do that, Ma come back. She had a glass of hot toddy, and she went to the bed and stood there with it, and Pap turned his head and looked at it. What's that, he said. But Ma never answered. Then he sat up in bed and drawed a long, shuddering breath. We could hear it. And after a minute, he put his hand out for the toddy and sat there holding it and drawing his breath, and then he'd taken a sip of it. I, Godfrey, if him and all of them put together think they can keep me from working on my own church like every other man, he better be a good man to try it. He'd taken another sip of the toddy. Then he'd taken a long one. Arsonist, he said. Work units, dog units, and now arsonist. I, Godfrey, what are they? Yes, sir.
Mr. Parker, why do you choose to so often have your characters dressed in vestments of the Christian myth, making them at times Christ-like, people like Popeye or Joe Christmas or even Benji, making them at other times Madonna-like, such as the woman in Sanctuary, and at other times Judas-like, such as Lucas Birch in White Northern?
I think a writer has to write out of his experience, his background. He also has a sort of lumber room, like the carpenter has a lumber room, a room full of scraps of boards of this and that. And when he finds that he needs something to tell the story he's trying to tell, he looks around in the lumber room, he finds a board that he can use. And since my past is, or my background is a Christian background, my education is the norm of education followed the Christian symbols. I used them as the carpenter uses the boards that fit the job. I'm not trying to write about symbols at all. I'm writing about people. But I use these symbols simply because they are shortcuts to help me tell the story I'm trying to tell. Yes,
sir. Why do you sometimes satirize the South and other times very, very strenuously satirize it? And what is your general feeling of the South and the Deep South?
It's my country, my native land, and I love it. I'm not trying to satirize it. I'm not expressing my own ideas in the stories I tell. I'm telling about people. And these people express ideas which sometimes are mine, sometimes are not mine. But I myself am not trying to satirize my country. I love it. And it has its faults, and I will try to correct them, but I wouldn't try to correct them when I'm writing a story, because I'm talking about people there. Yes.
When you draw your characters, they're probably composites, I imagine, of people you have met and known, but is there any special character or characters you draw on more than others from real life?
No, it's the writer has three sources: observation, imagination, and experience. And doubt, I probably, even he can't say at one time just how much of each one he has used. He is too busy trying to make a human being that is alive, that will stand up and cast a shadow behind him. And the writer is completely immoral, and he will take what he needs where he finds, because he is perfectly willing for anyone to take from him what they find in what he has done that they can use. Yes, sir.
What would you say would be the relation in this rather charming story you just read to the, what kind of lumber did you pick from back to build this story? What would you know of it? Seeing
here
and how did you shape it to make it different from what you might have known in
life? Well, these people that I know, they are my people, and I love them. They might well have done this. I just got to it before they did.
Yes. I want to ask an entirely different question. I've got some students who are creative writing students, and I might have some suggestions, just general suggestions as beginning writers should have. Great writing.
The first thing to do, I think, is to read. To read and to read and to read. As I say, the writer has got to have a lumber room like the carpenter, and the best lumber room he can have is the good books to read and to read and to read. The next thing is to watch people, to try to understand why people do what they do, whether the motives are good motives or base motives, to understand, to not judge their motives, just to understand it. And then to work. I think if the young writer can follow those three rules, he can make his own rules to suit his particular case as he goes along, but they are good general rules, I think, for a young writer to follow. Yes,
sir. Sir, you said he has to read the good books. What were the good books that you read?
Well, by the good books, I mean the books that have people still read 102 and 300 years afterward. And they would be what we call the classics. They're good books, printed today. But I meant only books that people have still read enough so that they are still remembered and still known. Doesn't mean that the books themselves are good. It means that they were good enough that people still like to read them. And since they have have continued to read them for these 100 or 200 or 300 years, they'll probably continue for another 300 or 400. Yes, sir.
Sir, must a writer always be objective, or must he get in and actually sort of live what he is writing about? In other words, make it a part of an integral part of his life.
To be completely objective, you'll become a reporter. I used to think that it took talent to be a writer, but now I think it takes mostly insight. That means to wonder, to speculate always why people do what they do. And you've got to be inside people. You've got to love people at the same time that you hate people to do that. You can't be on the outside, then you're just a reporter. You've got to be in the middle of life to write about it, and that's what you're writing about, you know, life is motion. Yes, ma'am.
Has anyone ever
had to write to him? I doubt if you can know anybody, or imaginary character, or living person without passing judgment on them. That's a little too godlike. You've got to pass judgment, you've got to love, you've got to hate even the character that you have created yourself.
Ms. Falker, where is your objective in using long sentences over short sentences? Do you think, is that a stream of consciousness effect, or do you feel you convey your thoughts either by the...
That is a matter of the carpenter trying to find the hammer or the axe that he thinks will do the best job. Another thing is, everyone has a foreknowledge of death. That is, he will have only a very short time comparatively to do the work. And he is trying to put the whole history of the human heart on the head of a pen, you might say. Also, to me, no man is himself. He is the sum of his past. There's no such thing really as was, because the past, it is. It's a part of every man, every woman, at every moment. All the his and her ancestry, background, is all a part of him, of himself and herself at any moment. And so a man, or a character in a story, at any moment of action, is not just himself as he is then. He is all that made him.